couch of potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Today's new movies I'm going to be talking about include Incredibles 2, Tag, Superfly, Won't You Be My Neighbor, and The Seagull. I'll also be talking about some news, the trailer park, box office, and the home cinema roundup featuring Tomb Raider on Blu-ray. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And you can reach out to me on Twitter at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
There's a ton of development stuff. Entertainment Weekly had a big profile on the Aquaman movie coming up, but that's essentially marketing at this point. But if you're talking about actual, like, things that make news, it's been a slow week. Probably the biggest piece that's kind of I find interesting is that Avengers Infinity War finally topped $2 billion worldwide, which is huge. And that's going to lead into Ant-Man and the Wasp doing well over 4th of July weekend. But the thing I kind of want to address, and I talked a little bit about this last week, but I think the box office of Ocean's 8 and Hereditary, the narrative drives it in this industry. When it comes to reporting for film, we're not talking about covering some major summit or some news that's really going to change your life or impact you. You're talking about box office, about numbers of people going to see movies and how many people went to go see them. So there's a lot of wiggle room in terms of the importance of entertainment reporting. And it's very much driven by the narrative. And the narrative right now, everyone wants every female-led movie to succeed. And they are almost heaping on praise needlessly for it. And I think that's also part of the reason why you saw such an attack on Solo. This was even before the whole Kelly Marie Tran thing, because Solo is nostalgia and it's about an existing character that's not a female. That's why there was a lot of support in the film journalism community for a film like Rogue One, because it had a female lead in the middle. And I mean, this industry is very much driven by that. And if you look at how they reported Ocean's 8, absolutely it was. Because one of the things that was reported is that Ocean's 8 got a high watermark in terms of box office for opening weekend. And that's kind of true. And the reason I say kind of is one of the things when it comes to box office, part of what makes it easy to report box office is there's always records being broken. Not because movies are better or do more significantly well now than any other movie. I mean, yeah, when you get penetration into a worldwide marketplace, it makes a difference. But you just have inflation. And naturally, a movie that's released now is going to do better than a movie that was released 20 years ago because tickets cost more. I remember when Jurassic Park came out, it was like $50-some million opening weekend, which was phenomenal back in 1993. If this next Jurassic Park movie makes only $50 million opening weekend, heads are going to roll. Ocean's 8 made about $42 million. And people are saying, oh, it did better than the other Ocean's movies. And I'm like, whoa, hold on a second. It's been over 10 years since the last Ocean's movie, Ocean's 13, came out. And if you actually look at those movies, those were all, I think one was in like 2000 or 2001 to 2007. So it kind of spanned that first decade of the 21st century. And those, you could kind of do a one-to-one comparison on those, because any of them are only a couple years from each other. And they were all in the high 30s. Well, you're like, oh, well, Ocean's 8, ergo, women are better, and women drive box office better. More women went to see it. Not true. If you adjust for inflation, the Ocean's movies were in like the $65 million run. $38 million back, you know, in 2004 or 2007, when the sequels came out, is like mid-60s, upper 60s now. So this is actually, if you go ticket sales, Ocean's 8 is in fact the lowest attended of the series. And that's not to take anything away from its box office win, but let's not call it the most popular of the series when it is in fact literally the opposite of it. And you also saw the same thing with Hereditary, which got a cinema score of D-, which I totally called. I don't think I said it on the show, but I mentioned it in various stations on the radio. I said Hereditary is going to get a just tank in the cinema score. Now, the cinema score is very specific. I've explained this before. They interview people opening day coming out of the movie. So you're already predisposed to like the movie. There were not people seeing Hereditary who only like romantic comedies. People who went to go see Hereditary were predisposed to want to see a horror movie. And when you get a D-, yes, that's the horror movies tend to be polarizing, but your mainstream horror audience rejected the film. And that generally doesn't bode well for its legs. Now, it did well. It was the highest opening for A24. But again, it's all based on budget. And the fact that it's just because it's A24 and they're a small company. And they've done these sort of smaller pictures out. They did that with It Comes at Night, and more importantly, they did it with The Witch, which ended up having some legs. But here's the point. You can't go out there and just dump all over Solo and say nobody saw that, but a ton of people went and saw Hereditary. Literally 10 times as many people went to go see Solo. It's all about budget. So you got to be careful of reading and getting sucked into the narrative. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. First one I want to hit really quickly is First Man. Opens on October 12th.
First man to walk on the moon. That'd be something.
We've chosen a job so difficult, requiring so many technological developments. We're going to have to start from scratch.
Neil, if his flight is successful, you'll go down in history. What kind of thoughts do you have about that?
We're planning on the flight being successful.
This isn't just another trip, Neil. You're not just going to work.
Do you think you're coming back?
This is directed by Damien Chazelle, who directed La La Land and Whiplash. And it's the biopic of Neil Armstrong. And I love movies about the space race. I love movies about that era, you know, the late 60s, early 70s, movies like Apollo 13, The Right Stuff. My problem with this movie is this just doesn't wow me. This just doesn't have the gee whiz factor. This doesn't feel like the guy who directed La La Land directed this. This feels like the guy who directed Blue Valentine directed this. It looks punishing and dull. I don't know. This doesn't seem inspiring to me. This just seems racked with anger and negative emotions. It doesn't seem like this is going to be what you want a space race movie to be. So I'm really cynical about this one. The trailer did not grab me in the least. The next trailer I want to hit really quickly is Halloween, which opens on October 19th.
Everyone in my family like turns into a nutcase this time of year.
Yeah, I mean, your grandmother is Laurie Strode. She was almost murdered.
Do you know that I pray every night that he would escape?
The bus crashed.
Mom, what bus crashed?
Michael escaped. He's waited for this night. He's waited for me. I've waited for him.
This is technically Halloween 11. It's the 11th Halloween movie, but they're ignoring everything past the first film. So literally every single one of the sequels, they're ignoring. And they're basically doing a sequel. They're doing like a Halloween 2. And, well, there's two things. First of all, it's the third movie in the series called Halloween. It's kind of like when they made The Thing and it was a prequel to The Thing. That didn't quite make sense to call a prequel and the sequel the same thing. And yes, it's nice to see Jamie Lee Curtis doing the role again of Laurie Strode. But I'm getting tired of the retconning on Halloween is so over the top. You almost need to have a flowchart to decide which sequels count and which don't. And like they already like ignored all the sequels when they did Halloween H2O and they only made it a sequel to Halloween 2. And now this one's going to be a sequel with Jamie Lee Curtis. You just leave it alone. Anything that would make me excited about this movie is gone. Just make either continue it or redo it. But just messing up and having a flowchart for sequels is just annoying. That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Tag and Superfly. Hey, oh, And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump right into the movie reviews. Let's start off with Tag. You're it. A group of friends who have been playing tag for 30 years pull out all the stops to go after one of their own who hasn't been tagged ever before he gets married and quits the game.
Our group of friends has been playing the same game of tag for 30 years.
What?
For the entire month of May, every year, we play tag.
You pushed me.
You never know when someone's going to pop up.
Congratulations, buddy. You're it.
Doing great, Anna.
Our buddy Jerry is the best that ever played.
And now he wants to retire.
Never been tagged. Just saying.
So who's it?
You can't touch it.
This is the year we get Jerry.
Synchronize your watches.
I don't know how to do that.
I don't wear a watch.
Time is a construct.
This is actually based on a true story. I don't know the whole details of the true story, but what's interesting is at the end of the movie, over the credits, they actually show clips of these guys playing tag because they like will follow themselves with an iPhone and videotape themselves tagging somebody else. And that's kind of fun to watch because you do see the real people behind it. Now, of course, the real people, there's like a dozen or two of guys that are doing it. And, you know, so there's more people. They only did it for 23 years. And when you see them, you realize that they're a lot older because I think the article came out in 2013 and they don't look like they were necessarily in middle school in 1990, which is when the game would have started. But that's neither here nor there. The fact that the people did this, I think, is really kind of cool. And it does make a good article. The movie itself, they just kind of write their own story around it. And they've got this group of friends, and the main ones are played by Ed Helms and John Hamm and Jake Johnson and Hannibal Buress. And they're trying to go after their friend Jerry, who's played by Jeremy Renner. Now, let's set him aside for a second. The four guys that are going after him, they're hilarious. They absolutely are, and they got great chemistry. And you expect people like Jake Johnson and Ed Helms to be funny. And of course, Hannibal Buress kind of plays his deadpan version of himself. But you always forget how much of a knack John Hamm has for comedy. And you've seen him do comedy before. You saw him do Baby Driver last year. But he was also in Bridesmaids. He was very funny in Bridesmaids. And I remember he was in the movie Absolutely Fabulous a couple of years ago. And he was great in that movie. But he actually has a great knack for comedy. And he's great in this movie as well. And they also have Ela Fisher playing Ed Helms' wife, and she's just as into the game as anyone else, if not more, but she can't play because they made the rules when they were nine and no girls allowed. So she's along for the ride, but not actually playing the game. And she's great in the film. And the interaction between these guys, with the exception of just, I mean, overdoing it on the weed humor with Jake Johnson, his character plays a stoner. And it's just like, I'm getting the feel that Jake Johnson is going to turn into like a low rent Seth Rogen, where everything he does has to be about pot. And it's like, fine, I get it. You like smoking pot. That doesn't have to be every single freaking character you play. And it just kind of gets in the way in this movie. He's supposed to be kind of the loser version of the group. But it's old jokes. So there's some things that are good, some things are bad. But overall, their comedy and their chemistry together with this group, including Ela Fisher in there, is hilarious. Now, what's funny is they got Annabelle Wallace playing the writer from the Wall Street Journal that is writing this article about this tag game, because the tag article originally did come out in the Wall Street Journal. And the problem with Annabelle Wallace, first of all, she's gorgeous. She's younger than everybody else in the cast. Everyone else is in their 40s, including like Ela Fisher, who looks great, by the way. And Annabelle Wallace is in her 30s. She's very beautiful, but I've never been all that compelled by her as an actress. Maybe it's because she's hiding her accent, because I believe she's originally British. But she was in movies like Annabelle, not to be confused with her name. She was in The Brothers Grimsby, playing a small bit part, and most notably, she was also in The Mummy, but I've always kind of found she's beautiful, but not much to her as an actress. I don't find her all that interesting, and she's just sort of dead weight in this movie. They could have lost the whole reporter following them around, because I don't know who she was. Maybe she was going to have a relationship with one of them, but it's just, her character's kind of pointless, and it exists more as a MacGuffin than anything else. Now, the Jeremy Renner character... Here's my problem with the Jeremy Renner character. His character never has been tagged, and he's really good at avoiding it, obviously. But he kind of feels like that friend who always played basketball with a group of kids, but only chose those kids because he could beat them. And if that kid had ever gotten beaten in basketball, or if another kid who was better than him kind of joined the game, he would take his ball and go home. And I never liked those kind of people growing up. I never liked the person who was only your friend because they were better than you at something. That's not a true friend. And I don't feel he's a true friend. And then he's getting married to a character played by Leslie Bibb. And her character's awful. Her character is horrid. Her character is the kind of character that if you went to this person's wedding and you met her and you heard some of the things she said, you'd be like, I pity you for the rest of your life because you're going to be married to this creature. Because her whole thing is like, my family's always had May weddings and it's going to be the happiest weekend of my life and don't ruin it. And I'm like, if you're looking at your wedding as the happiest weekend of your life, if your wedding is the pinnacle of your life, especially if you're in your 40s like she is, then you're pathetic. There's more to life than a party where you're the center of attention. And if that's what you look forward to, you have a problem. And I don't think you're a good person. And there's other things that go on in the movie that make them very unappealing. And that's my problem with it. They are not good people. And I don't like movies with not good people. All the rest of the guys, they're genuinely decent characters. They seem like, at least in the framework of their own foibles in the movies, they're decent guys. But not the other ones, not Jeremy Renner's character, not against Jeremy Renner. I mean, the guy broke his arm, I think, during the production. So he was all in for it. But him and his fiance, I didn't particularly like. But overall, I mean, it's a fun movie. It's raunchy and it's R-rated, but it's not forcibly so. It's not like they're trying to just push all the limits. They didn't say, okay, we're going to get an R rating. We're going to do the grossest, most extreme stuff. There's sex jokes. There's a lot of humor in here that works and it lands and it's funny, but it's not trying too hard. So overall, I mean, it's a fun movie. So I'm going to give Tag Kind of Rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's just hit Superfly really quickly because I kind of have to. Superfly is a remake of the 1972 blaxploitation film in which a criminal mastermind from Atlanta goes on one big score against the Mexican drug cartels.
I've been working these streets since I was 11. I swapped cash for crypto and redefined the hustle. You've been operating under the radar. All of that's about to change. This new crew, they have cartel connections. And they're coming after everything we have and everyone we love.
What's the play here?
One last score is so big that we will never have to look over our shoulder again.
Full disclosure, I've never seen the Superfly movies, either this one or the original. I have some blind spots in my blaxploitation knowledge. But I will say this, the 70s were the 70s, and I'm familiar with some blaxploitation films, and you can't recreate that. There was something culturally happening. It's kind of like when they did the Death Wish remake. There was something culturally happening that made Death Wish work and click back in the 70s that didn't quite work this time, and it's not just because Eli Roth's not that good of a director. And I think that there's something going on with Superfly. There's something going on culturally in our country where Superfly could click, and this just seems like another, just a run-of-the-mill drug dealer movie. Plus, I'm getting so tired of the plot of, we got one last big score. And then he says, no one's going to come after us. I'm like, if you do a big enough score, you're always going to have people coming after you. This wasn't screened. It opened on Wednesday. I just didn't have time to go see it. And I wasn't bending over backwards, too. I think this is for a very limited audience, which is why they didn't screen it. So I'm going to have to say it gets a preemptive suck.
It sucks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Incredibles 2 and The Seagull. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump back into the movie reviews with Incredibles 2. Pixar's family of superheroes is back. Picking up from the final scene of the last film, Elastigirl gets a corporate sponsor while the dad stays home to take care of the kids.
Superheroes are illegal.
We want to fight bad guys.
I am a bad guy.
It defines who I am.
We're not saying you have what?
Someone on TV said it.
I was approached by this tycoon. Wants to talk about hero stuff.
Help me bring supers back into the sunlight. We need Elastigirl.
Bye, sweetie.
I'll watch the kids, no problem.
I couldn't have done this if you hadn't taken over so well.
I've got to succeed so she can succeed.
I always get nervous when any movie company makes a sequel to a beloved movie that it really felt like a one-shot deal. Not that you can't have continuing adventures with superheroes, which is essentially what The Incredibles was, but that it kind of was a one-shot movie and it was perfect. It's one of my favorite movies of all time. It's one of my favorite Pixar films, and it's one of my favorite superhero movies of all time. Granted, this came out in 2004, the original, and that predated the whole Marvel run with the Avengers series by 4 years. And especially in 2004, it's one of the best superhero movies. Even up against the, whatever, 500 Marvel movies that came after it, it's still one of the best superhero movies. But it wasn't about superheroes. It was about a family. And that's what made the first Incredibles work. Then there are other things that were just a lot of fun about it. It had sort of that future retro feel to it. It had, you know, that retro design, but it had this high technology. And it just was a very interesting movie. It had a great soundtrack, great character, great voices, great director. And Brad Bird, so they brought him and everyone back for The Incredibles. And when it comes to the Pixar sequels that they've been starting to make, some of them I think are great and hit it out of the park and are just as good as the original, like Finding Dory, I thought did something very wonderful with what was kind of already established as a one-shot story in the first film. Then you have stuff like Monsters Incorporated, which I always thought was a cute movie, and Monsters University worked. It certainly was an enjoyable movie, but it still felt a little bit more like it was a manufactured sequel than an organic sequel. One of my favorite things about this new Incredibles is it feels very much like a direct continuation of the first movie, not just because it literally picks up from the very scene that ends the first film, but it looks the same. It feels the same. You have the same voices. And even though like Holly Hunter and Craig T. Nelson have aged 14 years since the last film, you know, the voice doesn't age all that much. And so you can kind of just continue into the next movie. You don't get this 15-year gap where they're suddenly on the outs with everybody and everyone's got to fight and they got to come back together. It continues the story because there's still the struggle of being a family. Being a family is an everyday struggle. The universe is constantly throwing garbage in your face and you're trying to stop it and protect your family and get around things. And there's always challenges every day for the family. There is no happily ever after because you always have to work as a family to get by. And that's the beauty of families. And that's how this movie works. And while there's been 14 years of technology improvements at Pixar and emulation experience and digital experience, this movie, of course, looks way better than the original, even though the original looks great. This one looks even more slick, and it has incredible animation and beautiful scenery and really cool characters that have these really cool powers that are realized in such a neat way. It's not about that. The movie's about the family. And yes, we've seen the Mr. Mom storyline before, but we've usually not seen a Mr. Mom trying to wrangle a baby who can shoot laser beams out of his eyes. I've done the Mr. Mom thing. I took care of my kids. I raised them, changed a lot of diapers in my day. And I can relate to that. And while they do make some easy digs at like new math, but that's not what the movie's about. The movie's about the family trying to stay together and help each other out and be critical to each other. And that's what makes the movie work. And yes, you have all the other cool stuff. Yes, you got Frozone back and he's a lot of fun. And yeah, you've got a neat little villain. But at its heart and soul, Incredibles 2 is about a family trying to get by. And that's how it works. Pixar has in the past shut down production and gone back to stage one to fix the storylines. They've done that with some of the Toy Story movies. That's why I think this movie works. I think it works as a superhero movie and it works as a family movie. And to me, this is very much like Finding Dory, where it captures the same flavor and it pushes the story in the direction it needs to go. So I'm going to have to say that The Incredibles 2 is a fantastic little film and it totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk a little bit about The Seagull. In this adaptation of the Anton Chekhov play, a young playwright with an overbearing mother struggles with feelings for his muse, who is in love with another man.
Even the thought of her makes my heart race.
No, no, don't be shy. He's a celebrity, but he has a simple soul.
Boris Trigorin, he's so famous. He looked young.
He is young and accomplished, don't remind me.
It's not often I have the occasion to meet young, interesting women.
What does it feel like to be famous?
Marsha, why is my son so depressed?
He's heart sick.
Are you that infatuated with her?
I am going to tear this love out of my heart.
How are you going to do that?
I'll get married.
Full disclosure, I am not familiar with Chekhov's work. But with that blind spot, I can't criticize this movie for the problems that I had with it because it was a story that was written in like 1896. And if they do a very fair adaptation of it, then that would be a problem I had with a piece of literature or performance art that was made 120 years ago. So it does feel archaic. It's a period piece. And it suffers in a lot of ways from the angst of love that is unearned. All these characters love each other. And these love feelings, from where I sit, they're really more either lust or longing or rejection of their current life, and they see that as an escape. And yeah, it's a somewhat lighthearted play at times. Sometimes it's heavier, but it's at times a lighthearted play, but it's also a play that it structures itself around caustic characters, but in a more whimsical setting, at least in the beginning. The acting's good. Annette Bening is annoying in the movie, but that's the role she plays. She plays the mother. Saoirse Ronan plays the muse, which is kind of an interesting choice because Saoirse Ronan's a beautiful girl, but she's not like that. She's not like Margot Robbie, that Margot Robbie will walk in a room and turn heads. Saoirse Ronan will make herself up, and she's actually a very beautiful girl, but she's a little more subtle. And so they make her the big muse. And there are, it's very Russian because it has all that angst and it has all that the struggling with their own emotions. Elizabeth Moss's character is sardonically hilarious at times. She's the one in the trailer who says, "I'm going to kill that love in my heart. I'm going to get married." So my biggest thing is it's not my cup of tea. It's a period piece. It's kind of a dull story. I don't feel the love story is developed the way it should be, or the way it could be, or at least where modern love exists now. And as somebody who's in a marriage, who's very happy in it, they miss the point of, whimsical, just I love you. And you see that in great literature too, because you see that in Shakespeare, Romeo and Juliet. Romeo and Juliet fall in love for no reason other than they're just horny teenagers. And it's just love, 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 love. That's all. I always see you. Oh, I guess I love you. And the same thing happens in Much Ado About Nothing. People just decide, oh, I guess I love you. Which is a very old-fashioned way of looking at love. And that's not the way it has evolved. So that gets in the way. But it could be a great adaptation of it. I've never seen the original play. So I'm just kind of, this is one of those, I normally do rocks or sucks. Can I just do the shrugging emoji of, I guess, because I didn't particularly like it, but I'm sure it's a good version of it. Still, I have to give a rating of some sort. So I'm going to have to say it kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the Fred Rogers documentary, Won't You Be My Neighbor? Along with the box office and the home cinema roundup featuring Tomb Raider. Stop it now. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish up with the movie reviews by talking about Won't You Be My Neighbor? This documentary looks at Fred Rogers and how his unique communication style with young children helped make his inspiring and successful television series.
A television program for children made its unauspicious debut on station WQED in Pittsburgh. Its host, Fred Rogers.
If you take all of the elements that make good television and do the exact opposite, you have Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
He was radical. I know everyone says that, but he was radical.
Won't you please, won't you please, please won't you be my neighbor?
I was born in 1971. So I was born just after the show started. But because I was born just after the show started, I may have missed the stuff from the 60s. But by the time we were in 1973, 1974, I was watching Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood quite religiously as a toddler child. And this TV show means a lot to me. And it's funny, you go through a series of changes as you look at Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. When you're a little kid, you love it. When you're a preschool kid, it is one of the best shows on TV because it talks directly to you. And Fred Rogers had an ability to cut through the noise and talk directly to a kid through television. And in this documentary, you see him interacting with other kids, like little kids in like public appearances or interviews or small group appearances. And he just knew how to get to your level because one of the things that irritates me as a parent, but it's even irritated me before I had kids, I hate when people talk down to kids. When people talk to kids, and they talk to kids like this, do you see how you talk like this? It makes them sound like an idiot. And a lot of adults do that. A lot of parents do that. And I've even seen teachers who deal with kids all day long do that. Usually if you got like a preschool teacher or a kindergarten teacher, they know how to talk to a kid. And they may talk directly and enunciate more and do more eye contact, but you still got to realize that that's a person inside. They're not just a shell of a doll. It's a human being. And you can adjust your tone and you can adjust your voice so that you can talk at their level, but not down to their level. And that's one of the things that Fred Rogers always was able to do. And I recognized that as a kid. Now, of course, by the time you're like five, you grow out of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And then it becomes annoying because that's what happens with preschool programming. And then you begin to just hate Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood because it's so babyish. And I remember with my sister, we were kids, you know, we're single digits and we'd be watching Mr. Rogers. And we got to the point that we'd like make fun of it, kind of a la Mystery Science Theater style. Of course, you know, predating that show by about 10 years. And then it just becomes a non-entity and you don't even think about it. And then you see things about it as a grown-up and especially as a parent. And then you start to realize that's when you really fully appreciate it. When you see the profound effect that he had on kids and cutting through the noise and talking directly to them, even through a TV set, it was fascinating. And that's when you find the true meaning of it. And I'm watching this documentary and I'm tearing up at moments that you wouldn't think you'd tear up. And I knew all the words to all these songs. Won't You Be My Neighbor? It's such a good feeling. All these different songs that he would sing every day. And I found myself transported back to what it was like to be a little kid watching this and remembering what it was like to watch Fred Rogers on TV. And on top of all this, here we are at a time, especially now, in a world that's so contentious, and particularly in America, in American politics, in the national conversation, where people are fighting for media space, and the way you make yourself more known is being more aggressive and mean and sniping and attacking other people. That's how you get heard, because there's so many options out there. And Fred Rogers was the absolute opposite. He'd pull back and he'd be quieter and he'd talk directly to the kids. We don't have a Mr. Rogers Neighborhood anymore. And it's, you know, it's less relevant now because you're talking about the issues and things that he talked about were real and still are. You're looking at a 70s show by kids who now have iPhones. That's hard to cut through that noise. We could use more for Fred Rogers today. We really could use Mr. Rogers again. And that's what this movie shows. It's a beautiful documentary on who he was as a man and making the case for the fact that he was that person on screen, off screen as well. And while he could have adult conversations, and yes, he got mad and he had issues at times and he had his own demons and he had his own problems, but he kept his cool. And they have interviews with his kids and they talk about kind of what it was like dealing with them, and they're very polite, but you knew that there are times when he would get mad and he had his foibles, And that's why this movie is so fascinating, because it's like a slap in the face. You realize, oh my God, this was so important to a generation. And yeah, I've heard all the things where people saying, oh, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood created a generation of snowflakes because everyone believes they're special when they haven't earned it. There is nothing wrong with telling a child that they're special and unique and wonderful and important. Every child should have that. And if you don't think that that's true, then you are a bad person. That is the right way to handle things. Now, can kids misbehave? Yes. Can kids do bad things? Can kids grow up to be terrible people? True. And kids can become bullies even at a very young age. But you need to cut through that. And what he showed with his series was how important it was to make that connection a personal connection to a child and become an influence on them. And one of the things I found fascinating about this is here you have an ordained minister who was a lifelong Republican, basically giving what a lot of people considered this hippy-dippy message. And it's not that. And if anything, you want to talk about religion? Fred Rogers was an ordained pastor, and he never made his show about religion. But boy, if he didn't teach religious values in it, real religious values. I'm talking about like Jesus religious values, not people warping whatever politics they want to make their point through biblical scripture. I'm talking about golden rule teachings, going back to what Jesus was really about. But he did this over how many hundreds of shows he did without pulling out a Bible and preaching to kids, because he knew that there are going to be kids that came from religious backgrounds. There are going to be kids that were going to be Protestant and Catholic watching his shows. There are going to be kids that come from atheist households. There are going to be kids coming from Muslim and Jewish households and Hindu households and Buddhist households and every different type. And so he said it's unimportant which a label it, as long as the message and the approach is appropriate. And then people can discover what they want to later in life. And that's why he was a true man of God just as much as he was a true teacher. And this comes out in this documentary. This is one of the best films of the year so far. Won't You Be My Neighbor? Fantastic movie, totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Tomb Raider. This reboot of the Lara Croft series sees a young, imperfect heroine searching for her father.
I think I know where my dad went.
That's right in the middle of the Devil's Sea.
It'll be an adventure.
Death is not an adventure.
Seven years, I've been on this island. Your father, he put me here. Now I see the likeness. Intelligence. The recklessness.
I was frustrated with this movie because so many people poo-pooed it. And I saw, I don't know how many people say, well, the Angelina Jolie movies are better. They're fun. And I have to ask, when was the last time you've seen those Angelina Jolie movies? Because they are freaking awful. Especially the first one, which I thought was kind of good back then. But it was, what, like 2000 was that made? And you watch it now, it's incomprehensible. The characters are garbage. The special effects are crap. This movie actually gives a nice treatment, kind of a Batman Begins kind of early life of Lara Croft. And I think Alicia Vikander's great in it. And I find it funny, you know, I talked earlier this show about the narrative, how it gets in the way. Well, we got to pump up all the women movies. Unless it's a movie that we hate. Where was all the support for Tomb Raider this spring? They wanted Tomb Raider to fail, and they were happy to see it fail. I don't know what they have against Alicia Vikander, but I think she's fantastic. I'd love to see more of these. I love Jungle Adventure movies, and I thought this was fun. It's not great. It's not going to be groundbreaking. Check it out. It's worth checking out. It kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Other movies that are out this week on DVD and Blu-ray include Strangers Pray at Night, The Hurricane Heist, Sherlock Gnomes, Love, Simon, Will and Grace, The Revival, Season 1, and Orange is the New Black Season 5. That is it for this week. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about Jurassic World, Fallen Kingdom. And until then, have a fat time at the movies.